agency is forming. Right now, social media is a hot mess, right? It's a global electric brain, but it's like it has a seizure. And that's because it's not very coherent. And we have not really found out a way to make it completely coherent, but we see bubbles of coherence. For instance, I find that my own social media bubble is very pleasant, but I also exclude everything from it that makes it unpleasant. And I suspect that in many ways, people are not using social media to become coherent. A lot of people basically log in because they like to get into fights or to watch fights. And social media is happily obliging. And in real life, or in meet space, we have norms against getting into fights with strangers because it's rarely productive. And I suspect that if you want to be coherent and have collective agency on social media, we need to find out how to build societies on social media, how to become coherent at scale.
So I guess a part of the issue is just that our communities have grown and that it gets harder with larger communities to have collective agency, right?
Is it larger to be smart with a larger brain? Maybe it is. Maybe our brain is a Goldilocks size and was larger. We would be less intelligent. I don't know that. If it was smaller, it would probably be bad. Maybe there's an ideal size. But if it gets larger, it probably needs different mechanisms to create order. And we're still exploring these spaces. I don't think it's hopeless. I think that we need to separate sometimes concerns. There are many voices that are mixing in the same space. When you make a symphonic orchestra or a wrestling match, you probably don't want to have them on the same stage. They all have their space, but at the moment these spaces are mixed.
Thank you. Certainly blew my mind.
It can read lane markers and tell you whether you're in the lane or not. All of these things that used to be thought of as the exclusive purview of humans. It was only humans that could do these kinds of things. You know, that being good at chess was something that distinguished humans from other sorts of creatures, that we were rational animals in the Greek sense of the word. And now it's getting really serious, where we have computers that are, like DALL-E, creating images, some of which I've used myself. We have computers that are copying human language so that they sound like humans. Google's Music LM is creating music, pieces of music based on text prompts, just like the DALL-E and other programs create artwork based on text prompts or visual images in any way.
Speech recognition, that this is clearly here for natural language understanding or something a little bit rather separate. It's what we're seeing now is a convergence of different technologies into a single model. So it's made this a very, very interesting time to be in the field.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Just a reminder before I get to you, Catherine, please submit your questions by scanning the QR code, but also
for example, ask a neural network to justify a decision about, say, sentencing in the same way that you could ask a human judge to justify that decision. And so that's one area that I think we really need to spend some effort into developing tools and techniques to look inside that black box and figure out. But one of the things that we can do and we should be doing is looking at how these systems work in the real world. So judging whether they are exhibiting bias against particular groups by judging how they're working on real people's data. There are many examples of how face recognition systems and speech recognition systems end up performing worse on particular demographics, particular groups of people, just because of the way that they've been trained or the sort of data that they've already seen is not representative of the real world. And so we really need to be spending time and effort, say, taking a speech recognition system and making sure that it works across a range of accents with a similar kind of accuracy, or looking at face recognition systems and being sure that they are actually performing well for different people, because when these systems are used in the world and they become part of everybody's day-to-day life, obviously it pulls people back if these systems are treating them differently to other groups of people. So that's a real area that I think is receiving quite a lot of attention right now. People are trying to understand how neural networks are working, and we're making progress in how to evaluate them for actual real-world problems.
When we talk about emergent properties as well, some people would argue that consciousness is an emergent property of a brain.
Thank you.
is the kind of robot where the human can convey to its machine assistants his own concepts, suggested strategies, and the machine, the robot, can understand it. But no machine can accept and utilize concepts from a person unless he has some kind of window on the same world that the person sees. And therefore, to be an intelligent robot, to a useful as an intelligent understanding assistant, robots are going to have artificial eyes, artificial ears, artificial sense of touch. It's just essential.
And indeed, they're being given these senses already. That same robot has now been given enough visual sense for it to avoid knocking Snoopy off his perch. But it's banged its elbow, so it assesses the situation with its TV eye and takes avoiding action and steers around Snoopy another way. A dim car welding robot wouldn't even know Snoopy was there. Now, a computer that could see things for itself would represent a quantum jump in artificial intelligence. Professor Igor Alexander at Brunel University in England has connected a TV camera to a computer and taught it to recognize faces.
Hello, Bruce. Hello, John.
The computer immediately spots the odd man out. The security applications are obvious, but how does the computer manage to recognize such a variable pattern as a human face? The answer is a direct crib from the human brain. It's wired up as an artificial neural network with a maze of interconnections. This neural network enables the computer to take an intelligent guess at the identity of the face it's looking at. Even changing your expression doesn't put it off. On the contrary, the computer responds accordingly.
Hello, Igor. Hello, Igor. Hello, Igor. Hello, Igor.
The same program can read words, and not just words written in computer code. Signatures, for example. Could this be a way to speed up the rate at which computers can learn? We asked Professor Alexander if his computer could be developed to read, say, Encyclopedia Britannica.
Reading is no problem at all. It's extracting meaning from what's being read that is difficult. That's our project for the moment. In this laboratory, we're developing an artificial neural network, which we hope very soon will do just that.
Computers seem set to learn at a rate which far outstrips our speed of learning. They may even understand what they learn. But the hallmark of human intelligence is the Eureka effect. Will computers be able to come up with anything new?
Well, we might also ask, can a human generate anything new? I think human beings are excellent at being able to put ideas together and come up with something that appears new. I think in the same sense.
And we can see how far they get. Yes. So this is what you get from 1.5 hours of training to learn how to walk. And this is a better use of data. You take that same amount of data, exactly, one-to-one, and you use it to create a self-image. Now, of course, if you had an infinite amount of data, you could do an even better job. So what we did, we really interested in understanding what is the ratio, what is the, to quantify the benefit of self-modeling. What is the benefit of being able to imagine yourself? So this is a simulation version of this one. We did this for lots of different situations, and we found out an interesting thing. So here's progress compared to how many trials you're allowed to do in the physical world, so how much data you can collect. If you don't have a self-model, if you have enough data, you can do pretty well. If you don't have enough data, you sort of use your data and you get to where you get. But the interesting is that if you only have a small amount of data, that gap is huge. in terms of what you can do with that data. If you have an infinite amount of data, you sort of outperform or you reach the same level. So that gap is the value add of being able to imagine yourself, for the robot to being imagining itself. So we're interested to see how that scales, because we don't want to just stop here and see how far it goes. So we took this robot and we changed it a little bit so that it has fewer degrees of freedom. In other words, it's a simpler robot. So when you take a simpler robot that has only 8 degrees of freedom, the difference between them is not as big. In other words, the advantage is not as profound. You take an even simpler robot with only 4 degrees of freedom, the advantage of being able to imagine yourself is almost negligent. So the message here is clear. We did this in lots of different robots and lots of shapes and sizes and situations and tasks. And you see, the more complex the system is, the more advantageous it is to be able to imagine yourself. It's an incredible gift that evolution gave us. It didn't give this gift to simpler organisms, but for complex organisms like us that have all these degrees of freedom, can do all kinds of things, the ability to imagine ourselves is incredible. You can see here the factor of improvement for a simple robot is, you know, this is the baseline of one factor improvement one, but you can see even the simple robots get an advantage. A robot with 16 or 17 degrees of freedom, we're talking about an advantage of a factor of 5 or 6. It's a huge advantage in terms of evolution. And for us humans that we have, you know, thousands of degrees of freedom and abilities, this is probably an incredible advantage compared to having to do things by trial and error. And for those of you who are technical or wondering how this is different than conventional reinforcement learning, I'll just say that in conventional machine learning, we build a model of everything. And that model is trained with data, and we move forward. Sometimes we call it the cube. And the only thing we did here is we separated that model into two sub-models, a model of the self and a model of everything else. And the reason this is useful is because you might need to learn a new model of the world for every new task, but the model of the self is constant across all tasks and all situations. If you have to think about one thing that is constant about all your experiences in life, it's you. And if you can model yourself, you take that big piece of this complexity out of the equation, and you only have to model other things. It's an incredible evolutionary advantage. So I'll show you one last thing. This is still unpublished, but getting there. We went on to create a sort of probabilistic model of self. Not a model that predicts where the foot are going to be or how to walk and all that. A probabilistic model that just, you give it the state of the robot and it tells you where the robot is. It's sort of like if you close your eyes and try to imagine where you are in space, this is what the robot sees. And to me, this is as exciting as probably landing from going to outer space, to see this moment where for the first time I can see how a robot sees itself. This is a very simple robot. It's nowhere close to human level of consciousness, but it's the beginning of a machine that can see itself. So I've shown you a couple examples of robots that learn to imagine themselves, increasingly complex, starting from stick figures to neural networks that predict their kinematics and so on, to actual deeper systems that actually where the robot is beginning to have a notion of where its body is and what it is and what it can and can't do.
Our computers will be able to analyze ideas that they already have, put them together in novel ways that will produce something quite dramatically new.
As an illustration, back at Stanford University, Professor Doug Leonard describes his computer program.
The research I'm currently involved in is the building of a program called Eurisco. Eurisco's task is to discover new knowledge. It does a kind of open-ended theory formation, almost like scientists carrying out research. Eurisco was started out with a set of about 100 very simple math concepts dealing with sets and functions. And after about an hour of running, the program discovered the notion of counting, natural numbers, and very quickly applied some more rules of thumb that it has to generate the notions we think of as arithmetic and elementary number theory. It eventually went on into geometry and rediscovered a lot of Euclid's theorems.
The most dramatic new knowledge Doug Leonard's program has generated seems at first sight merely incestuous. The brain power of a computer resides here, in thousands of tiny transistors etched onto a flat sheet of silicon the size of a tea leaf. Planning the internal connections for these minute components is a nightmare, and computers already help. Professor Leonard's program has come up with previously unimaginable three-dimensional chip designs that will make future computers far more powerful.
Are we ever going to realize, Anna, when a machine might become sentient? Do you think that's even possible? And B, how would we know?
The answer to the first question, is it even possible? I think the honest answer is that nobody really knows. The reason nobody really knows for a machine is that nobody really knows even for other animals, other human beings even. I cannot be 100% sure that you are conscious, though I think you are.
I'm trying.
And it's a unique problem in science. To try, in some sense, we know, and we've known for hundreds of thousands of years, that consciousness depends on the brain and the body in a fundamental way. You change the brain, you change your conscious experience. Yet, unlike other problems in biology, and indeed all of science, consciousness is a private, subjective experience. I can't put a conscious experience on the table and we can all look at it and agree. I can tell you about my experience, but it's essentially indirect. And that's some people have said this means we can't even address the problem with the tools of science and philosophy. I think that's entirely wrong. We can, it's just that there are going to be some limits on the data that we can get. Now, we are learning an increasing amount about what the basis of consciousness is in the human brain, which parts of the brain are necessary or not necessary. But we still don't know the answer to a fundamental question, which is, does consciousness depend on the stuff that something is made of? You and I are made out of carbon. We have biological neurons. We have wetware rather than hardware. Does that matter? Now, there's one school of thought that says it doesn't. If you program a computer the right way, if the next generation of machine learning architectures is trained in enough data, and the next thing that might emerge might be awareness, but there's no real good reason to assume that's the case. Some things, it doesn't matter what it's made of. A computer that plays chess really plays chess. But other things, the material matters, like a computer simulation of a weather forecast that we all use too. It doesn't actually get wet and windy inside the computer that simulates the weather. And consciousness is not the same thing as intelligence. And I think this is a crucial distinction to make, because it's so often said, like, not by anyone here, of course, but in the wider public, that consciousness is some function of intelligence, that once AI crosses some threshold, then the lights come on, and it's not only going to be smart, it's going to be sentient. But I think this comes from a place of human exceptionalism. We think we're really special as humans. We think we're intelligent, and we know we're conscious, so we think the things go together. But consciousness, we should define it actually. I mean, consciousness is really any kind of experience whatsoever. It feels like something to be a conscious system. An experience of pain or of seeing color is enough. You know, you don't have to have complex cognition going on in order to be conscious. So there's no real good reason to expect that simply ratcheting up intelligence is going to make an AI system conscious.
It's released by the pineal gland, and it goes directly into the brain. There's a very short path that allows your body to release DMT very fast if needed. But DMT experiences are remarkably similar to near-death experiences, where you become disembodied, you think or you communicate with an entity at the speed of thought, and even if it only lasts a few minutes or a few seconds, you can feel like a lifetime. There have been reports of people going through DMT experiences that have felt like centuries. And so between these artificially created experiences and then these accidental experiences, it seems like there is mounting evidence and consensus that materialism cannot explain all aspects of human consciousness, that our consciousness can in some cases be detached from our body. And of course, two deeply religious people who believe in souls all along are like, well, duh. right? But I was raised completely irreligious. I have never even read a page of religious scripture in my entire life. I've never read anything from the Bible. I've never read anything from the Torah or the Quran. So I'm coming to this from a completely irreligious perspective. Now,
thank you.
All right, let's go to mic number two.
Thank you so much for your talk.
This mission is too important.
Awareness. Without those components, an AI, no matter how complex, might remain a brilliant but unfeeling mimic. Couldn't we build conscious AI on purpose? If we understood the neural code of consciousness, we might design architectures that replicate its essential features. Global recurrent networks, neuromodulatory signals akin to dopamine, and real-time sensory grounding in the body. Question, if we succeeded, would that AI truly feel, or merely pretend?
Computer intelligence seems set to pull itself up by its own bootstraps. If ever intelligent computers learn to design super-intelligent computers, how will we get on with them? Professor Edward Fredkin has been a key figure at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology since artificial intelligence research began. He's also a highly successful businessman.
As these machines evolve, and as some intelligent machines design others, and they get to be smarter and smarter, it gets to be fairly difficult to imagine how you can have a machine that's millions of times smarter than the smartest person, and yet is really our slave doing what we want. We've been training chimpanzees to talk in sign language, and of course a lot of progress has been made there. But if we ever get a chimpanzee that can really communicate, and we try to talk to him, what we'd find is that he's interested in talking about things like where can he find a banana, and will you tickle me, or playing games that chimpanzees like to play. But if you want to talk to them about nuclear disarmament and who's going to be elected president, they simply won't be interested.
Beyond Turing tests to probe for genuine subjective states. Why does this matter? Because if consciousness can emerge in machines, it raises profound ethical and practical challenges.
Cancel that call for backup. Paramedics have arrived, waiting their decision.
Do you have a positive ID?
Finchley, first name B for Bartlett. Stand by, 10-4.
That man.
He was running in his bathroom.
Never saw anything like it.
What's his condition?
Flatline.
He's gone.
I put him down as DOA your arrival. Heart attack?
That's what it looks like. What happened here, you know?
Neighbors said they heard him shouting about something last night. He sounded scared.
What about?
Yeah, whatever it was, he took it with him.
Was he out here?
Right here, on the porch. Slumped down against the door. Eyes wide open, like he saw a ghost. I figure he's on his way to his car.
Which one?
At the curb. Never got to move it like I told him.
Must have.
And so on. So a lot of sort of beginning, as you say, day one of self-awareness, really not going, we're still very, very, these are very, very simple models, but I think they're on the path of this complexity. So you'll see a lot of these demos later on, the students who've actually built this thing. But I want to mention one personal angle to this. So.
Now, on the other hand, we would be very little interested in discussing for long what a chimpanzee has on its mind. Likewise, I think that the artificial intelligences of the future will be worried about weighty problems that we simply can't understand. And they may condescend to talk to us. They may amuse us on occasion or play games that we like to play. And in some sense, they might keep us as pets. I think that what that means really is they might solve some problems for us, like curing certain diseases. They might find it necessary to take some of our toys away, some of our hydrogen bombs and things, but there's no reason that they would want to go after the same things we want because they won't be interested in them.
I once owned a Porsche, a very high-powered sports car. I have nothing against high-powered sports cars. I don't want to get along with our technology and so on. I much enjoy driving it. But I wouldn't have let, say, any old 14-year-old boy drive the car. A Porsche in those hands is a dangerous instrument. I think the state of moral wisdom, say, of our society is such that it is at best a 14-year-old boy, perhaps an 11-year-old boy. And under those circumstances, the very, very powerful tools that we're making, and I'm thinking particularly of computers, I think have to be looked at as at least potentially very dangerous instruments.
Evidently, artificial intelligence means different things to different people. Like the elephant and the three blind men, one feels it to be a beast of burden to help us increase production. One fears it to be a dangerous serpent.
Would such AIs deserve rights? How would we ensure their well-being? And what would it mean for humanity's own uniqueness if our creations gained a mind of their own? Whether AI consciousness remains science fiction or becomes our next great discovery, wrestling with these questions now prepares us for a future where the line between human and machine might blur in unexpected ways. Consciousness, in humans, refers to subjective experience, what it feels like to be aware, to perceive, to suffer, or to decide. It includes elements like self-reflection, integration of information, and a sense of presence or identity. For AI, the challenge lies in defining whether these functions can be simulated or genuinely instantiated.
I guess it's on everyone's mind when we talk about smart machines. How smart can machines become? What are the limits of artificial intelligence?
Well, I to match the higher intelligence of the new Commodore 128, an Apple IIc would have to add three more 2Cs to expand to 512K, an extra keypad, 30-block graphics, color sprites, two more voices, four instruments, a cartridge port, a joystick port, and a Commodore 64, a Commodore 128 personal computer, a higher intelligence at a low ground.
And some of the difficulties that we're having in making programs smarter is that we're not sure exactly what it is we want to tell those programs about certain subjects. Another category is, once we figure that out, how do we represent the knowledge in the computer itself? And certain kinds of knowledge is proving a little difficult for us to represent it. The third category has to do with how that knowledge is used, and certainly there's various activities there that have been rather successful, but other things that really have to be done yet.
Is there a frustration level in this field in that there's a lot of hope of what you can do with something like AI, but yet, as you've pointed out, Niels, it seems harder perhaps than one thought to really put this into a practical application? John?
Well,
One thinks of it as a rope plan to rescue mankind in trouble. But what does the elephant think? Indeed, can a machine ever be said to think at all? Professor Mickey.
Well, I would say that it's not so much a matter of whether a machine can think or not, which is how you prefer to use words, but rather whether they can think in a sufficiently human-like way for people to have useful communication with them. It's rather the same as arguing whether a boat can swim. Our naval people will say, no, of course not, it sails. And what they mean is it doesn't make movements like a fish. On the other hand, the aero engineers have settled for a word like fly, and they say, yes, a bird flies, and so does an aeroplane. So that's really arguing about words.
I have read in the literature many times the view that the human mind is an ultra-fantastic thing, and we get along ordinary life using 5 or 10% of its capacity. And if we could only unleash the other 90%, we'd all be supermen. My opinion really is that just to get along in society takes maybe 110% of the capacity of a human mind. And as a result, many people are overloaded by just life, trying to get along in a very difficult world, and they get mentally ill, they get unhappy, and so on. And that we don't really have the capacity, the mental capacity, to manage complicated affairs like how should Russia and the United States get along in this world so that we don't drop thermonuclear bombs on each other. That's a question that may be too hard for us to deal with, and we may revert to the primitive passions that end up causing war just because we don't really have the mental capacity to solve these very hard problems and all the other things we have to do.
But if you get down to reality, what is important is whether you can program computers so that they can think and learn in a sufficiently human-like way to be really useful assistants and companions.
We've seen how computers can already communicate in written words that suit human beings. Getting intelligent machines to understand the spoken word is proving a tougher nut to crack.
Left, left, left. Down. Down.
This robot arm at the Machine Intelligence Research Unit at Edinburgh is learning to respond to vocal instructions.
Right. Right. Right.
It's important to realize that in a sense, the machine is learning this trick for our benefit. Today's intelligent robots tend to be more efficient if they work things out for themselves. This IBM robot at Yorktown Heights can draw a map of Japan. Big deal. But if you put in a smaller piece of paper, the system spots the change immediately and makes all the internal adjustments necessary to cope with the new problem. Marry the advances in intelligent robots to the evolution of intelligent computers, and the possibilities seem almost limitless.
There's absolutely no principle of science or even engineering or practicality that gives any hint as to why we would run into some limitation. It's clear that computers will be able to have enough memory. It's clear they'll be able to do enough processing. It's clear that in every physical way, the computer will be sufficient. The only thing that stands between us and having intelligent systems is one thing. There's a few things we don't know how to do, and we're making progress. And whether that progress will continue to come slowly over years and decades, I don't know.
But early in 1982, an announcement was made of a project that could catapult Professor Fredkin's projections much nearer than he expected. A team of Japanese computer scientists had visited all the major research centers for artificial intelligence in the USA, making careful notes. Then they went back home and launched a massive fifth-generation computer development program of their own. Head of MIT's Computer Science Laboratories, Professor Michael Detouzos.
I found out about the fifth generation computer project for the first time from one of my faculty who had gone to Japan, learned about it, came back and spoke to us, describing its aims. The aims of the fifth generation computer project are to construct machines and software that will understand spoken language in French, English, Japanese, whatever, that will translate language from one such language, such as Japanese, to another, such as English. and that will make possible expert systems, systems that can answer questions about law, about medicine, about finance, in effect, leading toward progressive automation of the service sector of the economy. I found myself and several of my colleagues in shock when we heard about it. The reason was that in that plan, we discerned pretty much, I would say 80%, of the research charter of our own laboratory, a laboratory that is aimed at researching the future 10, 15 years out.
This is not just academic peak. Co-founder of NASA's Goddard Space Research Institute, Professor Robert Jastrow, explains.
The whole idea, the idea of building a quasi-human brain, was in the province of the universities and the theorists, but it's suddenly become vital because the Japanese are trying to gain control of the world's computing industry from the United States. And you must remember, that's a $200 billion a year business, or soon will be, within 3 years. And that makes it the biggest business in the world, not the petroleum.
There is a certain level of technology in artificial intelligence today, and many people are making applications based on this technology. On the other hand, something that Niels said earlier rouses a thought in me.
Weather machine.
He said that we can put in the knowledge of a world-class expert. That's indeed true. We can put in the knowledge of a world-class expert, provided it fits into the format that the present programs allow. Namely,
in other words, if they're talking to each other through computer screens, so they can't see each other, they can't hear each other, but they're just chatting with one another the way we might nowadays through some kind of chat program. And so they're chatting with each other, and now what we do is we replace one of these two humans by a computer. But this is certainly seems to be one way to legitimately pass. Oh, if you have a very long conversation, it seems to sort of lose the thread at times. There also are ways that the human programmers have one, and interestingly, they also discuss meditation, that if we just think we're chatting to two different humans now, if we're not going to use the Turing test or something like that to determine them, is the assertion of non-self, that there isn't a unified, permanent, eternal, unchanging self within us. That what we are is a complex process, a causally interrelated and interacting set of parts, essentially, that creates a sense of self over a period of time. This radically displaces our normal, ordinary, everyday sense of self, replacing it with a much wiser and deeper understanding of the way things really are. And I would assert that a similar kind of thing happens when we contemplate these kinds of complex artificial intelligences. Because after all, chatbots like ChatGPT or Lambda, essentially what they do is, it's said, they come up with these lengthy, complex answers based on predictions of what the probability of the next word in a sentence is going to be.
One reason why I wanted to leave, because his job with his family was to smell stale food and smell for rat poison or not.
I want to talk a little bit today about robotics. We're going to talk a lot about robots. Interesting as the reality of what we're living in this world today. You know, no one who made a film in the 70s based on books from the 60s, based on ideas from the 40s, could have possibly anticipated that, you know, a vacuuming robot chasing a duck with a cat was interesting. The relationship that I seem to have with this big, giant thing that was following me around the lab like an excited puppy.
But it's all around us. We're using it the whole addressing some of society's most challenging problems right now, and with potential for the wrong things to happen. I think Catherine gave a lovely description of how we need the right guardrails and how we create and deploy this technology. And on the the other hand, this facet of impression of consciousness, which is a person's subjective experience. I experience consciousness. I'm guessing you experience something similar because, you know, we're all broadly the same, in the same species and so on. And this tremendously difficult question about knowing what a machine experiences, whether it experiences anything, I think that's one of the toughest problems in science, in a way. It's very hard to know even where to get started. I think just separating out those two, I think, is actually very helpful for the discussion and not conflating them.
Why do you think we have this obsession with wanting to have conscious machines?
Now, as Sarah James said, fair, it's such that a trope also science fiction. Radically underdescribes what's going on, because in order to do that, in order to have these predictions of what the next word in a sentence is going to be, it's got to have these incredibly complex, trained neural networks behind it. In the same way that we might say, human utterances come out of a very complex neural network of neurons, literal neurons, rather than artificial neurons in a computer.
It's used as part of more general facts, like if you heat the container enough, then the bacteria will be all killed, and the fact that if the container is not sterile and you empty it out onto a culture medium, then you'll get colonies of bacteria. And the still further fact is important, that if you leave the bacteria in food, then they will spoil it.
Niels, where do you see the future practically going in AI? What's the biggest potential market, if you will, for these kinds of applications?
Well, it seems to me that expert systems, as they have been going along, probably represents a rather large market, and we'll continue to develop systems that are less brittle over the next 5, 10, 15 years. Another very important application is computer programs that are able to converse with humans in English, everyday, ordinary language. And that's going to make computers accessible to a much wider variety of people.
They have an electronics infrastructure. They're competing very successfully with us in that sector. So they can rest on it and build the information on the machine. What more natural for them than to go after it? Now, whoever controls the information revolution is very much in the same position as whoever controlled the industrial revolution. In effect, think of what England and the United States had by way of control in the industrial era. And you have a picture of what Japan might have if it succeeds in the information era.
The Japanese have already taken steel and automobiles from the United States. If they win this one, they'll knock us back into the Stone Age. So we Americans have a tremendous stake in seeing that doesn't happen.
And what about the United Kingdom? Will we get a look in?
The UK can play a tremendous part, and there are initial stirrings already. Most people know that the Department of Industry, under the initiative of the Ministry of Information Technology, set up the ALVI Committee. They've recommended the spending over an 8-year period or so of very large sums of money in the hundreds of millions. Given that that can be put in the hands of the scientists who are actually going to do the job, and means taken to bring some of our lost exiles back from overseas, then we can do it. But so far, we've had a fine report, we've had many meetings, we've had a lot of talk, we've had no action, the funds are not yet reaching the people who have to do the work.
The picture for the future may be uncertain, but one thing can be guaranteed. Research will continue. If not here, then elsewhere. Economic aspects apart, we have to be sure that fifth-generation computers, super-intelligent machines, these quasi-human brains, as Professor Robert Jastrow calls them, are used in a humanitarian way. Specialists whose brains are picked to program expert systems are delighted to produce machines that are cleverer than they are. They feel a pride of authorship. But what about the rest of us, who, as Professor Weizenbaum said, have not been consulted? How will we feel? Over to Monte Carlo, where in 1979, Dr. Luigi Villa scaled the pinnacle of his gaming career by winning a glittering world championship tournament. The game was backgammon. Far away in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at Carnegie Mellon University, a computer program trained to learn backgammon had been devised by Dr. Hans Berliner. The
The day after Dr. Villa's world championship match, he played against Berliner's computer program. The computer's moves were made by a robot. The computer thrashed the world champion 7-1. What was Villa's reaction? Dr. Berliner would easily forget it.
Well, I think he was extremely disappointed at having won the world championship the previous day and now losing to a machine that he rather expected to beat rather easily. I told him I was sorry that it happened, and of course it was a nice day for me.
Never before has man had to share his planet with a competing intelligence. How can we assess the situation when it has no precedent? Professor Fredkin.
Now, there, when you put all of this into some kind of perspective, in some sort of universal terms, what we see is that, I think of it as three great events in sort of history. One might be like the creation of the universe, obviously. Biggest and most important event, the appearance of life, which is a almost magical organizing principle and is extremely diverse as we see on this planet, is another major event. A third one, which I think is equal in importance, is the appearance of artificial intelligence, which is a kind of form of life that's very different, that has possibilities for intellectual achievement that are hard for us to imagine.
Our descendant will not be the child of the loins, but the child of the brains, the thing we call the computer, which does not have to pass through the birth canal and does not grow by a tablespoonful of gray matter every 100,000 years, which is the case in the rapid growth of our brain, but grows a factor of 10 in power every 7 years. Generation. There's no question but that it will match us in narrow reasoning power by 1990 and go beyond us to become the great new intelligent race of the future.
And the question is, where will that lead us? Well, we're not the only creature on this planet to be able to do physical things, and many other creatures can do some of the physical things better. So we can't win a fight with the lions, for example. And on the intellectual area, once computers do that better than we can, I think it'll have actually very beneficial effect. Once the shock passes, the shock of knowing machines can do better than we can, that beneficial effect will be that we will have a burden off of our back, which is the burden of being the sort of supreme intellectual creature on the planet. We have to worry about everything today that isn't worried about by God. And when computers come along, they'll be able to worry about a lot of big questions that we're basically incompetent to worry about. What this will mean is that we will, in some sense, finally find our niche where we fit in, and there'll be a limit on the bottom, which we already know, but there'll be a limit on the top. Rather than being, in some sense, a limitation to us humans, I believe that that kind of having a niche will allow us to finally fulfill our destiny as humans, because we will know what we are and we'll be able to go about doing it and having fun, as it were, without worrying about all of the two big issues that we're in common.
Boyfriend made you come here.
He says I'm depressed much of the time.
early Buddhists had no notion of computers or artificial intelligence, but they knew about chariots. And one of the most famous metaphors in early Buddhism is the metaphor of the chariot, that a person is like a chariot, made up of parts, in particular, five parts, which are known as the five aggregates. If you don't know what those are, I'll leave a link to a video down below in the notes where I go through them. But basically, the five aggregates are, one, the aggregate of form, which is the body. We have a body, which we might consider partly the brain, the neurons, but then four mental parts that may depend upon the brain in various ways. And all of these are causally interrelated and interacting. This causal interrelation among these five different parts is what creates our idea of the self, of a person. And then it's important also to realize that each of these parts can be broken down into further parts. So the form, human body, can be broken up into the elements. And each of the four mental parts can be further broken down into subparts. So it's a very complex kind of interrelation of many, many different parts that are basically coming into being and going out of existence over a period of time.
All my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred. heart is numb. 'Twas like a ball from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling, for here lies love. All my dreams lost beyond recall, dreams of spring blasted into fall. Are dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love. Thank you.